around.
We're going to, we do not have a quorum, we need one more, but we're going to start the hearing, and today we're going to hear House File 1329 from Representative Haas that relates to personal care attendance. So Representative, we'll save the motion until later. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, and also for your patience in the last few days, because this has been an ongoing and changing endeavor. But I'm going to be presenting this bill off the AO90442 amendment that I believe everybody has. This bill is essentially the PCA bill that deals with reforms that were a result of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. It deals with cuts and cost-saving realities that we have currently before us with our budget. And many of the sections also within this bill align with the governor's recommendations, which are included in House File 1517, authored by Representative Abler. The first 13 sections of the bill are mostly technical in nature and mostly reflect on the governor's proposals. But to go through the first 13 sections rather quickly, the first section requires that unlicensed PCA agencies provide rights or home care service rights to individuals receiving personal care attendance services. Sections 2 through 5 of the bill simply update references, and oftentimes references a new statute, the 0659 statute, which we'll be talking about later in the bill. Section 6 clarifies who can be paid as personal care assistant and specifies the conditions under which an unpaid guardian can also be a paid personal care assistant. Section 7 eliminates the requirement for a physician statement of need and also adds some of those who can be, some individuals who can be qualified professionals who supervise personal care assistants in their settings. Section 8 updates some definitions, clarifies different areas in a wide-ranging area of home care services, home residences, ventilator dependency, authorization, exemption criteria, so on and so forth, which is rather technical. Section 9 requires the commissioner to post on home care information information on the website. I'm hoping that this can be a tool that individuals and consumers can use to see about the agency that they may be going through or to learn more about the services provided. Section 10 recodifies existing language defining home health agency services. Section 11 is also recodification for existing language governing private duty nursing. Section 12 updates some language with PCA assessment, and Section 13 updates language governing personal care and qualified professional authorization. Section 14, I would probably say, though, is the majority of this bill. It's essentially all new language, and if I can find it on my bill, I can make sure I'm following along with myself.
Page 28.
Okay. Section 14, Mr. Chair, and Subdivision 1 is essentially definitions from everywhere from activities of daily living to critical activities of daily living, managerial, official, qualified professionals. I don't need to go line by line on that. Subdivision 2 talks about PCA services that are covered, such as activities of daily living, health-related procedures, assistance with behavioral needs, and instrumental activities of daily living. It also addresses some other areas, such as a PCA may perform health-related procedures associated with complex health-related needs if they're trained by a qualified professional and demonstrate competency in that area. Then also for more intense needs, such as ventilator support or tracheostomies, PCAs can do some of the services as long as they're trained by a registered nurse. They use clean procedures and not sterile procedures, specialized training and individualized training, and supervised by an RN. So for our nurses on the committee, they have an important function to play. Subdivision 3 talks about non-covered PCA services when they're provided by a spouse, a parent of an individual who's under 18 years old, paid legal guardians, licensed foster care, child care or babysitting services, so on and so forth. Subdivision 4 deals with assessments for PCA services. This is something that came out of the legislative auditor's report, that there can be some inconsistencies in the assessments of individuals. But one of the main things that we're requiring is that you, the individual must be dependent of an activity of daily living on a daily basis and need tutoring to complete a task or hands-on assistance to complete a task. That's one of the components that does result in the cost savings in this legislation, that requirement of at least one activity of daily living. Subdivision 5, I should keep following with myself, Mr. Chair. Subdivision 5 deals with service and support planning, where the assessor with the recipient shall review the assessments and determine referrals for other payers, services, and community supports as they find appropriate. Recipient must be referred for an evaluation, services, or supports that are appropriate to meet the needs of the recipient. Subdivision 6 deals with the service plan, which is essentially the assessment. The service plan must be completed on a form determined by the commissioner and include a summary of the assessment with a description of the individual's needs, authorized amounts of hours, expected outcomes and goals of personal care attendant services. This must be also a copy of this must be given to a recipient, and the recipient must be given the information about the options in the program to allow for review and decision making by that individual. From the service plan, the personal care assistant's care plan is developed, and that care plan must be in the recipient's home. And it must include start and end dates of the plan, recipients, demographic information, emergency numbers, and a bunch of details that I don't need to go through one by one. Communication with the recipient's physician is in Subdivision 8, and that requires that communication with the physician about the PCA services is done and that it's verified and needed. Responsible party is a critical component of this legislation, action with the Never mind, I'll deal with that later, Mr. Chair. The responsible party essentially provides support and assists the recipients who live in the community. They must actively participate in the planning and directing of PCA services for the individual. A responsible party is required under certain circumstances. One, if the person is under 18, the person is incapacitated, or the assessment or the service plan determines that the recipient is in need of a responsible party. Subdivision 10 deals with duties and delegations of that responsible party. I'll let you read that if you would like. Subdivision 11 deals with personal care assistant requirements. A few requirements is that they must be supervised by a qualified professional every 60 days. They must be employed by a provider agency. They have to enroll with the Department of Human Services after clearing a background check. They can't be a consumer of PCA services. They must maintain daily written records and other tasks such as that. PCAs are also limited to 310 hours per month of services. This is regardless of how many recipients are served. The 310-hour cap is also another area in which we anticipate to save some dollars in, and that should be reflected in the future fiscal notes. Subdivision 12 deals with documentation of PCA services. Subdivision 13 deals with qualified professional qualifications. This is an important component because they do offer supervision, and this is one of the areas identified in the legislative body's report that supervision is needed. Qualified professionals provide duties of training, supervision, evaluation of the PCA staff, and evaluation of the effectiveness of the services provided. Subdivision 14 deals with the professional duties of the qualified professional. Subdivision 15 deals with flexible use. Essentially what flexible use is you know, we know that a one size doesn't fit everybody all the time, that medical needs oftentimes can be fluctuating, and a person is given a set number of hours per year. What can happen is, I wasn't sure if somebody was signing to me or something. But mainly what a person could divide up their year in 6-month intervals, and they can use up to 75% of their allotted hours in 1 6-month interval in case more intensive services are needed in that time. Shared options in Subdivision 16 simply deals with a PCA who can serve 2 or 3 recipients at a time. The rates are established in shared services under subdivision 17. Those rates cannot exceed more than 1.5 times the individual rate for those who are being, two individuals are being served by a PCA. If three individuals are being served by a PCA, the rate cannot exceed 2 times the individual rate. Subdivision 18 deals with personal care assistance choice options. The choice option is a more flexible option that allows the recipient or the responsible party to be able to do pretty much the hiring and firing decisions and delegation of that authority over the personal care assistance. Personal care assistant choice options has certain qualifications. They have to meet the same standards and PCA provider agency standards that are within the regular PCA program. Same training, the whole work. Personal care assistance choice options administration in subdivision 20 just addresses that some issues with the PCA provider, the recipient, the responsible party, the qualified professional, and the personal care assistant themselves. That duties of each party have to be written out. Salary and benefits have to be within that written form. The fee that the agency gets for doing the administration of like payroll and expenses of that and procedures for hiring and termination are all in those required documentation. Also, there's a new policy. There'll be an encumbrance that the personal care attendant is a qualified professional, that their wages and rates must use up at least 75% of the reimbursement rate. That is making sure that those providing services are getting a fair amount on their wages and benefits out of that reimbursement rate, much like we do for long-term care facilities and nursing homes right now. Subdivision 21 deals with requirements for PCA provider agencies, some detailed things like proof of surety bonds, contract information, proof of workers' compensation, all those types of details. Subdivision 22 is that an annual review of PCA providers must be done, where all the information stated in Subdivision 21 must be resubmitted on an annual basis to the department. Subdivision 23 deals with enrollment requirements following termination. If an agency is terminated, that they cannot re-enroll back as a provider after 2 years. And if they do re-enroll after that 2 years, they have to have a one-year probation period. Subdivision 24 deals with PCA provider agency general duties. This is another area that will have the encumbrance, so we make sure that we cover both regular PCA and also PCA choice. I'm going to do a 75% encumbrance also there. Currently, the bill states 65 and 70%. That will be one of my amendments shortly, Mr. Chair. Subdivision 25 deals with background studies. Subdivision 26 deals with provider agency disease prevention plans and policies and procedures. 27 deals with ventilator training. 28 deals with required documentation for provider agencies. Last thing, I'll just go through the last two sections. Section 15 says that managed care must use their fee-for-service forms for their authorization processes, the forms or timeline standards, documentation, and data reporting requirements. They must use their fee-for-service forms for the commissioner on that. That's to try to make things a little more standardized and hopefully a little less administratively heavy for PCA agencies. Section 16 clarifies that for PCA, Representative Powell, you might like this, for unlicensed PCA providers, that if there's child maltreatment, that the counties are the responsible party for those investigations, and that if they are licensed providers, that it's the Department of Human Services. That is generally considered to be the current practice, but we're just clarifying that in statute. Section 17 deals with abuse prevention plans. Section 18 deals with some changes in consultation with stakeholder groups, that if there's changes for cost savings that we want to try to find after 2011, that stakeholders be consulted in that and reported back to the committees of jurisdiction, which would be this committee, reported back next year to us. Because PCA services and the cost that we see associated, it's grown 160% in the last 5 years, Mr. Chair, of the cost with PCAs. We may need in the future to try to find some more cost savings, since we know that the fiscal demands on us aren't going to end after this session. Section 19 system, I believe I did. Oh, Section 19 requires the Department of Human Services report back to the committee about some of the changes from this bill, the training that they're requiring of the PCA agencies and PCAs, audits of financial integrity, all those types of things that they report back to the committee next year for that. Section 20 is essentially revisor's instructions, and 21 is a repealer of what, if this passes, outdated language. Try to make it quick, Mr. Chair.
Well, we now have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order, and Representative Hosh will then move House File 1329, be recommended to pass, and then he moves the amendment numbered A090442 is what he's just described to us, and so in order to get the bill in the form that the author wants, we need a vote in favor of the delete all amendments. So all those in favor, should ask if there's any discussion first. Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, signify it by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So, Representative Hosh, you you have further comments then about the fiscal note and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, there is not an official fiscal note at this time. Some preliminary information, we hope that this will have a cost savings in this biennium of $25 million, and in the out biennium of 2012 and 2013 of $50 million. Yes.
Mr. Wallace, could you comment on the fiscal note and your discussions with the Department of Human Services?
Mr. Chair, included in your packet is a one-page cost estimate or cost savings estimate from the department, which is labeled PCA reduced hours, one ADL threshold is labeled at the top, which shows a savings of about $20 million in this biennium and $42 in the next biennium. They have, subsequent to the to sending this sheet over, they have identified additional savings in the amendment of $5 million in the 10-11 biennium and $8 million in 12 and 13.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Hosh, could you just give us an idea of how many meetings you've held on this? private meetings that saved us all a lot of work. You want to go, just give us a little hint of the process that you went through to get this bill to us.
Well, Mr. Chair, this was one of the things that we first dealt with at the very beginning of session with the OLA report, and I think personal care attendant services are one that we all value, because we know that you'd much rather keep somebody in their home than in an institutional setting or a setting in which is an entitlement under our MA program. And with that value and also the recognition we need to save money, I've met with many stakeholders from the Disability Law Center to the Centers of Independent Living, to ARC, to the health plan, to the department, to anybody else that has any concern with this, with the workers and the personal care attendants themselves. And it's been, I can't tell you how many meetings there's been. but I do hope with the tough decisions that we do have, some of these are ones that aren't made with any excitement, but I do hope that the result of our work is a bill that people can get behind with some level of support and say that this is going to improve services, improve integrity, and improve the future for many people. I hope that's going to be the result of this bill. And if anybody wants to continue to meet, I'm happy to do so also.
For Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoffman, my questions are somewhat similar. I'm trying to figure out, you know, for all of us, this committee is so big, you know, we're usually trying to figure out the cost compared to the governor. Is this that comes in under, and also, has anybody, any groups endorsed your proposal? So kind of the cost issues, the same two issues, just on a broader basis.
Yeah, we're going to ask if there's anybody that wants to comment from the audience. But
just wondered if, you know, there's got to be, like, herd center or those types of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flawick, the bill doesn't save as much as the governor. There are some differences. The governor requires, under his proposal, that two activities of daily living be with the requirements for services. I have that down to one. Plus, that I allow for a behavioral threshold, a level one behavioral threshold, to also qualify for services to make sure. And that's, there's three different levels of behavioral thresholds. Level one is the highest, in which needs probably the most intensive help for completing some activities. I also have that as being allowed to get TCA services. So we do have some reduced savings in there, but between reduced hours, the 310-hour cap, and some other reforms, I still think we were able to save a significant amount of money. Do any groups support this bill? I hope, I think a lot of the groups can live with this bill. I think everybody, especially for stakeholders within the disability community, have some concerns. I mean, because some people will either lose PCA services or they'll be reduced hours. Not everybody, but some. And that's always concerning.
Sure. And I think that's something we're seeing overall in health human services. I think of Representative Bond and her dental reform and you and this reform and these kind of, and the governor's proposals were massive. I mean, their reforms proposed. So it is, I mean, obviously you have to do what you have to do during these times. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, although this bill does have cost savings measures in it, I think it's got some very good reform measures also, and that's something we should keep our eye on. You know, some of the concerns that were indicated in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's Report were concerning. There was some lack of controls and some errors with billing and the whole work, but we don't want that to reflect poorly on the importance of PCA services. And I think with some of these reforms, we're going to be able to continue some of the value and outlook that people have on PCA services as being one of value and not one of suspect or susceptible to misuse. And I think this bill is going to only strengthen that too.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hodge. Sounds like you've done a lot of work on this, and I'm really grateful for that. As you were walking through the various sections, I was interested in Section 19, and in particular, you know, sort of looking at results. And I don't know if this is a question for you or maybe it's, you know, for the department, but I am kind of curious about how we're going to monitor going forward to the outcome differences between where we've been and where we're headed. In terms of the status of the people with PCA. So, how, for instance, you know, are we going to see sort of a steady state, a status quo equilibrium around hospitalization, or are we going to see an uptick in hospitalization as a result of changes, or will we see a change in nursing home admissions as a result of this? And, you know, we may not, because a lot of people may be just great under this, but there may be some that struggle, and I'm just wondering if in all of the discussions you've had, if there's been thought about that, or if you have advice about that, or if there's someone else I should be talking to about that.
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I completely agree. And that's why I believe in both Section 18 and 19, we want some reporting back to the committee to kind of monitor where we've been and where we're going and also what some potential changes may be. I have no problem modifying Section 19 and expanding it if we can, as long, you know, as we know, any change could create a greater fiscal impact. But I completely agree that, you know, we don't want to cut off our nose to spite our face and, or be penny wise and pound foolish and save a few pennies here and then have some greater costs in another part of our system. So I couldn't agree more with your concerns.
And Mr.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hatch, you know, as you walked your way through this bill, it's clear that you are in this bill in your head, right? You are just walking us through what's here, and it's a result of a lot of work that you've done. So I don't want to insert myself at the end and say, oh, what about this part? But if I can be helpful to you, if you think that we can strengthen that area at all and I can be helpful, I'd really like to help you maybe put the cherry on top of the sundae that you've already brought us. Thank you.
Be happy to.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge. And I also want to thank you for all the work. I know that the OLA report was something that we were all very interested in, and I went back over my notes from that earlier this morning and had a couple of questions. First of all, on page 49 of the bill, subsection 23, enrollment requirements, one of the things that we looked at was the bad actors were terminated in some cases and just reformulated. So Bob's personal care became AAA personal care and under a new name and continued to operate without having to pay much of a penalty or be caught within that. And I'm reading through the section, and I just want to make sure that we're not punishing some of the folks who are working for these agencies who, through no fault of their own, work for a bad company. See, that's a terminated personal care assistance provider agency, including all named individuals on the current enrollment disclosure form, would be not eligible to enroll as a personal care assistance provider agency for 2 years. So it's the intent of the legislation that if you're working for one of these firms that is terminated, you could then work for another firm if you were not at fault for any of the reasons for termination. Is that correct?
Representative Hush.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I believe the enrollment disclosure form requires that anybody that has a 5% stake in the agency be listed. So it's actual ownership of that agency, not simply every worker. And that's from my interpretation. Yeah. And I'm seeing nodding heads.
And
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, secondly, just to that, to make sure that we are getting at the root, if we do terminate an agency, how difficult would it be to simply reformulate itself and to come back with different partners involved? Or is there a way that the bad actors, do you think that this covers that to prevent them from just changing their name or their corporate status and coming back and continuing to provide disservice?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the intention of Subdivision 23 is to cover those concerns in the Office of the Legislative Auditors Report. Is it going to be sufficient to take into account any circumstance for anybody trying to reconstitute themselves as another entity? I hope that this stops them from that, but I can't guarantee anything of that matter. But the point is, you know, with the disclosure of all ownership and stake in these agencies of 5% or greater, and that we do try to catch that, and I'm hopeful that's enough. I mean, we have some pretty detailed documentation requirements also within this.
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hodge, one of the other pieces of it that I was interested in from the OLA report was the waste, fraud, and abuse, but then collection of, let's say you bill Medicaid and Medicare, let's say you overbill clients, to going back, casting back, and then collecting some of the money that they owe the state. I didn't see that addressed formally in the collection process, either through the Department of Human Services or the Department of Revenue. Does anything in the bill really go after that, the money that's sitting out there that we want to collect back?
Representative Hush.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, there's nothing in this specific legislation that allows for like retroactive collection of false payments or claims, but I believe there's other areas of statute that allow for the department or for the state to be able to make those collections. And actually, we have another bill going through this process that Representative Simon is carrying for false claims that expand on that.
Representative Dean.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hodge, the 310 hours a week, it's about 310 a month, that's about 78 hours a week. Do you think that that is sufficient enough to get at the problem of overbilling for hours? That still seems like quite a lot of hours per week. Or do some people stay there for 24 hours at a time and rack up 3 days of 76 hours? Or How do you feel that that goes far enough into getting overbilling in time?
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. I think we need to remember that first with the assessment and the care plan has to determine how many hours that person needs in order to complete certain activities of daily living in order to stay in their home. That is probably going to be the strongest component that's going to prevent any overbilling, because you cannot bill more than what that care plan authorizes. The 310 hours probably wasn't put in this bill, at least in my opinion, wasn't put in this bill to address some of the overbilling that was done. That 310 hours was simply put in to be a cost-saving measure. So I think it's more of a care plan and the assessment that gets to the heart of that matter.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hodge, for all the work on it.
Representative Bunce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hodge, getting back to the, again, thank you for all your work on this great reform efforts and efforts at cost savings. First of all, is this sheet that I came in late that was handed out, is this the current, roughly the current status of your amendment here in terms of the cost savings over time, or am I not looking at the right thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, as this has been a moving process, I have not seen that sheet yet.
Oh, that's what we're all looking at.
But it's probably the numbers that I have in a different form.
Well, in the net in 2010, it says approximately three million, and then it goes up to 17, 20, and 22 in the next 3 years following that. Is that roughly what you're aware of?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, from the numbers that I have, has about $25 million in the 2010-2011 biennium and $50 million in the 2012-2013 biennium.
These numbers are lower than that.
They're a little lower.
The sheet that we're looking at is about a week old,
okay,
so there's newer data, but we don't have
the back to my question.
Form.
I just want to know if this is even in relation to this bill, so there's no marking on that. My question has to do with... relative to the current status of the program prior to this session, what percentage of cost reduction in this program does this represent?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, we spend about $400 million on PCA services at this point. That state and federal, I'm being told, $400 million.
So can someone tell us what percentage of state expenditures reduction this would represent of the next biennium?
It would be about half
that. Yeah, it's Medicaid, so you're looking at a 50% match.
So 200, and we're talking about, you said 25. So 25 over the 200, that gives me my percent. Okay. And separately from that, we know that this program experienced a lot of increase in growth rates over the last 6 years. That's a big part of why we're paying so much attention to it. I see we have more savings in out years. Do the changes you've implemented here, are they affecting those growth rates? Is that why we're seeing additional, are we expecting a slowing in growth? Well, and related to that, are we actually reducing not only percentage reduction in the cost of the program, but are we, how many people do we anticipate that went into this forecast of the reduction that we are dropping off the program under the new rules?
Representative Hodge. Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, we haven't seen the impacts yet, but I'm anticipating 500 to 800 people losing PCA services from these changes. The elevated numbers that you see in the out years are attributable to the growth. The growth that we've seen in the last 5 years simply isn't going to dissipate, because we know what the demographic shifts are in the state, both with those with disabilities being able to live longer and more independently, and also aging individuals becoming more in numbers in our society.
And Representative Bunn, there's also the federal participation, which is changing in the out years, right? You know, in the 10 and 11, most of it they'll be paying 62% and will be, yeah, but in 2011, we'll be back to 50%.
Okay.
Representative Bunn.
To follow up further, so I understand in terms of percent savings, we're talking about $25 million saved of the next biennium on a state share of around 200, and 500 to 800 people dropping off on a base of what?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, good question, because I do not know that right
now. I'll look for that.
Okay. I'm sure the department might be able to answer.
And then I have one,
one
final, Mr. Chair. Representative brought the issue of the cap on hours under the program. Two-part question related to that. How does that relate to the current hours that are allowed in the program? I know we heard that in testimony earlier. And how does it relate to the governor's cap?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vaughn, currently there is no cap. Mm-hmm. And it mirrors the governor's proposal with $310.
Is there someone from the department wishes to comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vaughn, $11,500 is currently.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to echo some of the comments that were made previously. Thank you, Representative Haas, for bringing this forward. I know it's a difficult question for all of us, and it's important that we do enact some reforms, and we have to do cost savings as well, and I think we've really tried to balance that as best we can. The question, well, first, I also want to say that I agree with Representative Murphy's comments about Section 19, about the evaluation piece. We get the OLA report frequently and try to enact it, and it's important to remember that it's an ongoing process here at the legislature, that we should be re-evaluating that periodically. The question I have is there an appeals process for individuals who may be losing the PCA services? Is there anything in place that would address that?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, there is an appeals process for individuals who may receive reduced hours, a change in their service plan, and also if the people who will be losing potential services will be ones who aren't considered needing one activity of daily living or meeting that level one behavioral threshold. If they think they meet that, they could through an appeal process.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to, did you have some amendments that you wanted to make?
Two minor amendments at the time, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And they are. On page 46, line 16.
46, line 16.
Strike 70 and insert 75.
So, Representative Haas moves that on line 46, 16, the 70 be stricken and replaced with 75. Any discussion of that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So, that's adopted.
And then, line 49. Or page 49, line 27, 65 be stricken and 75 be inserted.
Oh, 27. So, Representative Haas moves that on page 49, line 27, the 65 be stricken and replaced with 75. Any discussion of that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. And then, is there anybody in the audience who would like to comment on this bill? So, Representative Rood, that question first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one in light of what we just amended here. Representative Haas, do you know what the average pay is for the PCA attendance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, it's wide-ranging. It can be near minimum wage to $12, $13 an hour. And it just depends on the agency.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society in Minneapolis. And we represent a lot of people who use PCA services of all ages and all types of disabilities, and so we've been very involved and concerned, and it is, I want to just echo this thank you to Representative Haas for really trying to find a way through this. We are definitely very supportive of the reforms, and we've worked very hard on them. I do want to just sort of give a little bit of history of how all this language and reform came to be, because it's so much, it couldn't possibly have happened just since the whole world crashed with our economy. And that's because the Department of Human Services have been working, even prior to the legislative auditor's report, to do reforms in this area because they knew that they needed to do it. The legislative audit report also came on. But the way that I look at this is that a whole lot of this language was a reform effort that we would have seen even if we'd had a big budget surplus. And then the economy crashed on top of it and we have cuts. So we really, I think, in the disability community are very strongly in support of improving integrity and assuring that this program is run in the best possible way. We cannot serve anyone who isn't in need of the service for any amount of time they don't need. That's very clear. So we're very, very supportive of the reforms. In terms of the cuts, we are also grateful that the cuts are less severe than the governor's budget. The eligibility cuts for the governor's budget, we're going to eliminate eligibility for over 2,000 people, and now we're talking 500 to 800. And one area that the governor had in his cuts was to force people who needed a responsible party to help oversee their care. Those folks would have had to move in with their responsible party. And that would really destabilize especially a lot of seniors. At Legal Aid, we've got clients who live in public housing, one-bedroom public housing places, and they're getting some PCA services and they're doing okay. Legally, they can't move someone else into their one-bedroom public housing apartment, and in terms of their income, they can't afford anywhere else to live. So we are quite concerned about what's going to happen. We also have some, there's another group of people affected that are relieved right now in terms of what's in the House budget, because we have parents of adults with quite significant disabilities who are being paid to provide some PCA hours and are keeping their loved one at home, you know, into their 30s and 40s. And because you're paid as a PCA, they can't be the responsible party. Well, you know, the income coming in allows them to pay the rent. So this was such a destabilizing proposal, so thank you very much that that's not included. The proposal that does save a lot of money, $15 million in this biennium and $31 million in the next, is the hours cut. And I think this will also be a very difficult thing for some people, and I think you will, in some areas especially, hear about it. And one of the saddest things about the cut, I think, to us in the disability community is that right now we have a program that can be individualized. You can be assessed based on whether you've got a bathroom on the first floor or whether your bathroom is wide enough to get a wheelchair through or you need somebody to help you get in there. Well, that's over. The hours now are going to be based on the median in your home care rating group. So whatever the middle person used in 2007 is going to be the base for everyone. And it means that 5,500 people estimated are going to be cut an average of 2 hours a day. And that means that some people at the higher ends of every home care rating are going to be cut quite a bit more. And once you're talking about losing 4 hours a day of PCA service, a lot of things are going to happen in your life. You're not going to have a full-time job to offer a PCA anymore, so you probably are going to lose a caregiver. And your hours are going to have to probably be split up, and that's very hard to fill, to get someone to drive out to your place to work for 1 or 2 hours and then drive out again later in the day to work for a few more hours. So it's going to be tough. It's very, very tough, and we're going to have to figure out a way to work through this, and we certainly will continue working on it. But thank you very much for all the work.
Thank you. Nick? Representative Murphy had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really not a question, but for Ms. Henry. You bring a lot of expertise to these issues. And the last thing that you were talking about, there are so many incidents that we're experiencing through this session that bring up exactly what you're talking about, that we're going to make some fundamental changes, hopefully not destroying, hopefully making better, but definitely changing how people experience care, service delivery, et cetera. So I hope that you'll remain engaged as you have in the past and help us with the evaluation as we go forward. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I have to say I really appreciate the comments to try to track what happens. I think that's very, very crucial. Because if we've gotten it wrong and we're really costing a lot more money, then we really need to make changes. Thank you.
Thank you. Patty Fritz.
Yeah, I just have a comment. Thank you. That's fine. For us, Ms. Henry, your last comment about the driving out to, say, for instance, in the morning to help a client out of bed and get dressed and do their ADLs in the morning and the hours spent, which are a couple of hours, let's say, and then out in greater Minnesota, where they will be driving in down in my district and are now, those 4 hours will be cut down to two, and then the client will be probably sat in a position or positioned in such a way that they will then have to wait again for that PCA to return in the evening or another for two more hours. I'm concerned, very concerned for all of the clients throughout the entire state. And yet I look at greater Minnesota and the cost of transportation. We have a huge transportation problem now for our folks, and I'm concerned that there won't be enough money for transportation to pay for the gas to get them there, and we'll lose people. And this is a low-paying job. This up to $12 an hour, that's still a low-paying job to do a lot of hard, back-breaking work.
Okay. Nick, again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Afterholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just want to, and nothing against everyone who's worked on this, Representative Haas, NAMI was not intimately involved in this. I think, as you know, this particular legislative session, the legislature as a whole has had a large number of working groups, a lot involving mental health, including special education. I think we've all felt a little stretched in terms of being able to be actively involved in all of them. One thing I just wanted to point out that no matter, if you're cutting that much money, there's pain involved. And while I realize that you tried to craft a bill that would hurt people as little as possible, I just wanted to be able to say for the record that there will be pain involved. I also want to say that of those 2,000, most people figured it was going to affect adults and children with mental illnesses the most. And what we really don't know is, even with the revised bill, how will that really affect them? Because you're talking about much more behavioral needs than necessarily, what we consider the normal activities of daily living. And so while I certainly appreciate the work that's gone into this by the other disability advocates, I've just been around too long and just want to kind of be on record as saying we're very nervous from, the mental health point of view about how this will really be implemented and how the kids and adults will be affected. And not really knowing if there's somewhere else that they can go. If they haven't been with an ARMS provider getting that service, in the past, will they really be able to qualify in the future for children under children's therapeutic services and supports? While we certainly have behavioral health aides, we know that we can't pay them very much and they're hard to recruit. And, we had hoped that we would at least create a career ladder so maybe we'd get people coming in to do the hours for low pay because we'll be able to be a mental health practitioner at some future point in time. But again, we're very concerned about how this will be implemented. We appreciate the work that's been done, but we really reserve the right to come back in a year and say, you really got it wrong.
Questions?
Thank you, I guess.
Thank you. Representative Slavik has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your comments are interesting. It reminds me of some of the things we've had happen in the education area where we think we're doing one thing and it does turn into another thing after session. Who does implement this? Representative Hosh, this is the Department of Human Services, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slavik, correct. And I want to make sure that the committee knows that one of my biggest concerns with the governor's original proposal was that the strip of the two ADLs would disproportionately impact those with behavioral issues. And that's why I have that level one behavior behavior threshold specifically in this, is to try to minimize that. And I want to stress minimize. It's not going to eliminate, but to minimize that impact.
Sure, I just Representative Posh, maybe Representative Bottom, people are doing these big reform proposals. Maybe we can figure out a way to work with the department so that we, our intent is played out throughout our proposals. What happened to us is our intent was not, and in some of the education things, specifically the allowances. And we lose control. I mean, once we're out of session. So just to comment, if there's a way to somehow, you know, once the gavel is down, that we can continue, or you can continue to be involved and make sure the intent is met.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fogg, I would be happy to let you know if we start hearing of, you know, families and adults calling in.
We can certainly, you know, if we get those calls, we can have hearings when we're not in session, the Healthcare Access Commission will be operating, so they can oversee some of these things. But as most of you know, I'm big on measuring what we do, and we need to make sure that we keep track of what's going on. So, there. Next.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Hancock. I'm the executive director at the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. And one of the many services that we provide at the Metropolitan Center, or MCIL as we more routinely call it, are PCA-related services. So we, Representative Potts has included us in several of those many meetings that you asked about, Mr. Chair, earlier. And we were grateful for the opportunity to be involved in the discussions as we worked through the process of trying to come up with alternatives to some of the original proposals. And I appreciate the opportunity this afternoon to provide just a few quick comments on that as well. I want to echo Ann's comments that she made. We're certainly very, very appreciative of Representative Posh and the efforts and the time and the sweat and the passion that I know went into developing this bill. And I know that a lot of what's taken place this session, quite obviously, has been the result of the OLA report. And as we move forward with finalizing some of our decisions and reaching compromise on the various PCA bills that are out there, as valuable and as informative as this report was, I think it's also very, very important to remember that while it's a very broad report, it covers a lot of areas and it has a lot of breadth. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a lot of depth. And what I mean by that is that the data that's contained in this report, in large part, was gathered from 26 site visits with 26 different provider agencies. There are over 500 in the state of Minnesota, so that's a little less than a 5% random sample. And through the very thorough evaluation of the timesheet collected from 229 DSPs, direct service professionals. That is less than 1%. There are 45,000 DSPs working in the state of Minnesota. So again, while there is some very valuable information in here about training standards and that type of information, very, very helpful. And Representative Posh has incorporated a lot of that into his language. I think it's also really important to take the OLA report in its context and that we don't make too many decisions that take us beyond what the report was really intended to tell us. Representative Dean asked the question earlier as well about the ability to recoup the over expenditures. And between 2005 and 2007, the time period covered by this report, the Attorney General's office, I believe, was able to recoup about $856,000 in overpayments. During that same time period, we received $1.5 billion was spent on the PCA program in the state. So that's about a 0.08% abuse rate. Now, $856,000, don't misunderstand me, members, that's a lot of money. And I'm not being dismissive about that. I certainly wouldn't want to have to sit down and write a check for that because it would bounce. I mean, really high. But again, keeping it in the context, if we could. A couple of other things I just wanted to mention. Representative Potts limits the ADLs, as you've already heard, to one. And the governor's version calls for two ADLs. The Department of Human Services has told us themselves that with two ADLs, it would almost immediately knock between 2,000 and 2,200 people immediately out of eligibility for PCA services. You heard from Ms. Abderholden that a large percentage of those individuals would likely be people with behavioral issues or mental health diagnosis. The other part of that argument is that we have no way of knowing what percentage of those individuals would ultimately have to seek out-of-home placement. And I can assure you that seeking out-of-home placement would be far more costly than supporting the person with personal care center services in their private home. So as we move through, again, in that spirit of compromise with the various versions, keep in mind what that one, I mean, just moving that number up by one notch, the impact that it can have. Representative Dean also asked a question about policing the 310 hours, and it was a very good question. And if I may add to Representative Haas's response and remind the committee that every service provider, as well as every single PCA, every one of the PCAs that are working in the state of Minnesota right now has an individual provider number. And that's how we track on a daily basis. And as a provider of PCA services, when we bill for those hours, we bill on a daily basis. So those hours are tracked on a daily basis tied directly to that individual's individualized provider number. So the ability to police that, and you know, DHS has given us that mechanism to do that, so it's a cooperative and collaborative tool, but allows us to track the use of those hours on a daily basis. So there are safeguards in place. The 500 to 800 individuals that would potentially lose services, even under Representative Haas's bill, again, I would remind the committee that we have no way of knowing how many of those individuals may or may not ultimately face out-of-home placement. And we could be back here in 2 years having a similar discussion about the high cost of services, but it will be nursing home-based, not PCA or community-based. And I want to thank Representative Haas. I know that one of the issues in particular that he spent a lot of time considering was the minimum wage and benefit rate that has to be passed on. There were questions from several of the members about the average pay rate, and it really is all over the board. You can find some agencies and organizations, entities that pay, you know, eight and a quarter an hour. You'll find some organizations that pay over 13. Our top wage level is at the Metro Center for Independent Living is 13 and a quarter. So we're well above that 75% already, and I actually, from my organization standpoint, applaud the 75%. In fact, it might even be a little too low, as far as I'm concerned, because I think PCAs, they are, as I said, 45,000 strong in the state of Minnesota. They are the individuals in the healthcare industry that are on the front line delivering some of the most intimate services that we call upon them, and yet they are the least paid. So thank you very much for the opportunity to share some comments. I don't know if I said anything constructive, but...
Representative Hayden, good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hancock, I just have a quick question.
Yes.
When you talked about the potential fraud or at least tracking the amount of hours in which providers and PCAs work, if I remember correctly, there was some issue about every PCA not having a PCA number and that some of the high... Some of the reimbursements that came in that looked like that they were excessive were due to multiple PCAs working under one PCA number or provider number. Can you expound on that a little bit, how that has changed? I don't know if it's changed in this bill or if we've had a policy change since then.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and Representative, one of the stories that's highlighted in the OLA report is the, and it was on the news, it was on Channel 9, it was in the newspaper. Mr. Wolf did several articles on it in the Star Tribune, and we could never get him to go back and say, oh, here's what really happened. In that particular situation, the agency, the provider, mistakenly billed all of the hours for their agency within a 24-hour period under one provider number, rather than splitting it as we are required to do. We are required to bill on a daily basis the individual provider number. When that request for reimbursement came into DHS, it immediately set off the red flag. DHS, by their own investigator's testimony in the Senate a couple months ago, said that sent off the red flag. They immediately sent out investigators to that agency site. They looked at the paperwork, immediately determined what was wrong, educated the provider, put the paperwork together in its proper form and resubmitted it, and everybody was paid. So it was what it really boiled down to was a clerical error, because you can't work as a PCA in the state of Minnesota without that individual provider number. As an organization that provides PCA services, if Joe Smith is working as a PCA, I can't bill for reimbursement of those hours unless he has a PCA number. So that was, in that particular instance that you referred to, it was a clerical error that was quickly corrected. So in my estimation, in that situation, the system works the way it was supposed to, the way it was designed to.
Just one follow-up.
Representative.
So what stops those that are a little more nefarious, who aren't, who just, it wasn't a clerical error that just said, you know, I'm gonna bill extra hours under, I'm gonna get some people who are unqualified, I'm gonna get a couple of PCAs that are qualified, and then we're gonna bill under them. I mean, how do we regulate those that aren't as ethical as say your agency?
Thank you, and Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a very, very good question. And it really, it starts from the very beginning. Whenever a PCA applies for a job at an organization, we are required to do background checks. If they fail the background check, they are not allowed to work. It would be illegal to assign them hours. Now, in any situation, in any program, you know, whether it's, or any service industry, whether it's a restaurant or the car repair shop or PCA services, there are opportunities where people are going to attempt to take advantage. One of the safeguards that's in place in the PCA program is that when a PCA fills out their timesheet, it has to be signed off on by the consumer, by the person who is receiving the services. So they get that first point of check just to look at that timesheet and say, well, wait a minute, you put down that you worked 6 hours today, you were only here three. So the consumer can disallow that timesheet. They can refuse to submit it. They can inform the agency that the PCA is claiming hours that they didn't work, and we notify DHS and it begins the process. So there are various points along that process. Are there occasions where maybe the PCA and the consumer come together and decide collaboratively that they're going to try to rip off the provider? Can it happen? Sure. I mean, just as in any industry, there is potential for fraud. But I think there are a lot of safeguards in place to catch that. We, in our organization, tend to have a pretty close relationship with most of the consumers all of the consumers that we provide services to. So we know what everybody's service hours are. We track them on a monthly basis and say, you're using your service hours at an accelerated rate, or you're underutilizing your service hours. So that's another way of kind of tracking their average daily usage, and you can get some indication if something's going on that shouldn't be.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question I have, and this is probably more for the department. This issue about whether this reduction in services and those individuals who might be dropped from this program may end up in out-of-home placement, I would hope, but I'd like to hear whether or not we have some ability already in place or plan to put something in place so we can track that, whether it's either this program change or possibly some effects from some other program changes as a result of the budget cuts this session. Can the agency give us an answer as to whether or not we will be able to monitor that in some way?
I have an opinion on that, but I think the department would rather answer it.
We're going to have to finish up here in about 10 minutes because we have session at 4.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Alex Botolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services. There are certainly ways we can monitor people if they remain in the system, mm-hmm. if we have continued assessments, if they access other services through whether the county or directly to the state, we can monitor what's happening. We may have issues if people no longer are involved with the county or public services.
Representative
Bob. It sounds like they have a capability of doing some of that, so Representative Hosh, might we consider putting in your bill that we will hear a report back by certain dates on that? So that maybe it's already in there, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, this was also a question from Representative Murphy dealing with section, I believe, section 19 of the bill. And after the questions and testimony, I will definitely be considering that to be reported back to the committee.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. We have at least one more wishes to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathleen Kelso, members of the committee. I'm with the Mental Health Association. It is to that point that I wanted to speak. The people who will disappear, those who have a major mental illness now and are receiving PCA services, seem to be in an invisible group. They are part of that 2,000. We don't know how many exactly, but I would venture to guess that even with the one ADL and the one behavior, if you look at the definition of that behavior, a good number of those people won't meet that threshold because that would probably mean they were quite ill. But they are making it in the community with the help of a PCA service. Without that PCA service, the handful of people that I've spoken with could be at risk for hospitalization or nursing home or whatever might be left in their community. And if they live in a far remote area of any given county, they won't necessarily have access to rehabilitation services that are now in supposedly in all counties, but not within reach of all people in all counties. So my caution is a lot of these people will disappear. They will not be in the system. They won't be countable, but they'll show up in other ways, in nursing homes and ER admissions and civil commitment. And if there's a way we can track that through Section 19, we would like to get some language in there to figure out how to do that. And so we'll be working with Representative Hosh and trying to accomplish that perhaps in the conference committee. But so I'm here to speak for those invisible 2,000 who we don't seem to know where they are or why they're even receiving PCA services. We just know that they've increased the amount of people who have, driven up the cost, but we really don't understand why. So perhaps the glass half empty, half full situation here is that it gives us an opportunity to find out who they are, where they are, and why they are on PCA services. And if there's something missing in the mental health system to deal with people, provide services for people who aren't in the rehab and recovery mode, but are in the community support mode in the community, then we need to figure out a whole different level of service for that group of people who don't receive PCA services. Thank you very much.
Okay, is there anybody else that would like to testify?
Mr. Chairman, I will be very brief. John Chia from Curry Center. I think just a clarification, there was a number that DHS gave before on the number of individuals receiving PCA services of 11,500. I believe that's a fee-for-service number and not a managed care number. So there are many more individuals receiving PCA services that are not accounted for in that number. And I think to the Section 19, the ever-evolving Section 19, and I've spoken to the Council of Health plans on this already, I think we're going to want to understand moving forward the difference between the fee-for-service population and the managed care population and what happens to these people in those different contexts. There may be individuals who move to an institutional setting. Certainly in a fee-for-service context, they're going to be on the hook for Medicaid spending in a managed care context. That will be the responsibility of the health plan for 6 months, but beyond 6 months, health plans aren't necessarily accountable for picking up the tab for those institutional expenses. We have worked with the health plans. We'll continue to work with the health plans on this. I'm certainly not casting aspersions by saying that and they have expressed the willingness to work with us. And I'm assuming that they'll still do so as this evolves and moves forward. So one other point to Representative Dean's question about the 310-hour limitation. I don't know if 310 hours is a magic number. I do know there are a number of individuals who do work for multiple agencies who do want to cobble together a living and stay in this profession and do work more than 8 hours, in some cases more than 10, 12 hours a day to serve these individuals. So with that, Mr. Chairman, have a good weekend.
Some of the members will have a better weekend than some of our staff people will be doing this weekend. So thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to briefly make a comment? And I don't see any, so I would like to thank you, Representative Hosh, for doing a very difficult job. We are making cuts that are going to hurt people. We know that. We know we're going to have to do it. And what we're trying to do it is do it in a way that minimizes the hurt. We know there's going to be hurt, but we're trying to minimize it. And most of us believe while we should get rid of all the waste and fraud that we can, there really isn't that much waste and fraud. There might be better organizations, a better way to deliver the services, but the savings that we're making in our budget are going to give pain to some individuals. Yeah, but I think Representative Hosh did a fantastic job of trying to minimize that pain. So, Representative Hosh renews his motion. And I was trying to figure out a way to say this, Representative Hosh. It goes for possible inclusion of the bill, and it's almost like it's impossible that it won't be included in the bill. But Representative Hosh renews his motion that 1329, as amended, be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, with that, the, yes, meeting is adjourned.